It's crucial in Buddhism for us to have a female ordination, because the path of the fully ordained monastic is the path that's available for people who want to devote their life to spiritual practice of the Dhamma. Within the Buddhist community, that's considered to be a very, very exalted and very honourable vocation that people can have the opportunity to choose, so that they can fully devote themselves to their spiritual practice, and so that they can receive the support of the community to do that. Currently, in some Buddhist countries, that option is only available to men. And so we have been trying to change this so that the option to ordain is equally available to women in all Buddhist cultures. Yes, I was very inspired and excited to hear about this project of doing a documentary on the female masters of spirituality, because it's crucial that we see what women are doing, that we not just read about it in books or talk about it, but that we see what the spiritual practitioners are doing within Buddhism. We see how they're living their lives, and we see how they're changing the way that Buddhism is and the way it's perceived. And unless we can provide an opportunity for the female practitioners to speak with their own voice, then we are just hearing the narrative, we're just hearing the story as told from the perspective of the monks. And for too long in Buddhism, that's been the only voice that we've heard. So it's a very refreshing and very important change to be able to hear the voice of the nuns to articulate their own understanding and their own practice. Project like this, like the Female Masters of Spirituality documentary, will raise awareness and raise consciousness of people about what is happening. And as long as we don't see what people are doing and how they're living, and as long as we don't see what's possible for female spiritual practitioners, then we simply won't be able to put our support behind it. So this is like a first step, which is there to make it possible for women to practice in a way that has equality and has dignity and has respect. One of the things which is very noticeable, certainly in Buddhism, and I think in spiritual traditions generally, is how many women there are. And if we run a meditation retreat or hold talks and all of these kinds of spiritual activities all around the world, it's mostly women who attend. And so there's an incredible vitality and interest in women for that spiritual practice. As long as we are not responding to that and not giving the women the respect that they deserve to be able to practice fully, then we're missing out on all of the contributions that they can be making. In a country like Taiwan, for example, where women have been supported to become bhikkhunis, they're running universities and colleges. They are taking responsibility. They're playing an important part in Dhamma education, but also in the life of the community, in running retreats and teachings, in advocating for social change, and obviously, especially in advocating for changes for the protection of women. And so these are kinds of things which the female community is going to do in many ways a lot better than the monks have been able to do. According to the Buddhist tradition, in the Theravadan countries, that's in the southern countries of Buddhism, there was a bhikkhuni tradition up until about 1,000 years or so ago. At that point, there's no further mentions of the bhikkhunis, and it's assumed that because there was a lot of war and social unrest at the time, that somehow the bhikkhuni monasteries were destroyed or they passed away. There wasn't the ability for them to sustain as an institution. So since that time, there are occasional mentions of bhikkhunis in historical records, but there's no real evidence for a continuous presence of bhikkhunis in the Theravadan countries since that time. that I go, I see that there are a lot of women who are interested in spiritual practice. We've just come from a retreat. And you know, we can see that on the retreat there are many people, many women there, interested in meditation, and that shows us that the traditional forms and the available forms of spirituality and spiritual practice are not meeting the needs for all women. There is something very powerful and very alluring about the idea of enlightenment and about the idea of a life which is dedicated towards the practice for enlightenment, and my feeling is that if this is available, that no matter what country we're in the world, that we will find that there are women who are interested and who will find spiritual nourishment and fulfillment through that practice. One of the things which is offered in the Buddhist tradition is the chance for lay people to come and spend time in a monastery to do meditation, to listen to teachings, and sometimes just to spend some peaceful time away from the cares of your life. And in most monasteries around the world, of course, it's easy for men to do that. In many places, there are also opportunities for lay women to come and practice, but typically it's a bit harder to come by, and the women sort of tend to be kind of shunted off to one corner of the monastery where you prefer to ignore them except at the meal time where they come and give you lots of lovely food, and that's all very good. And it makes it a lot harder for women to get access to teachings. It especially makes it harder for them to ask questions about things that might be personal or about, you know, relationship issues and all kinds of things that they might not feel comfortable about talking about with a monk. And so these are kinds of problems which, you know, from my point of view as a monk, it's very easy to overlook this, right? To not realize how important it is. But within a Buddhist community, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, they provide like an oasis or a sounding board or a place of like almost like a well that you can go to and find wisdom, find a time for reflection, and find some help to manage through the difficulties of life. And when there are women who are living that role, then they can do that in very important ways that men are not able to do. You know, and particularly, I've mentioned in cases of things like domestic violence, rape, child abuse, these kinds of issues where women suffer far more than men do, and it's difficult to find a monk or a man to talk to about these things in a way that they can listen to and that can be helpful. Reality is that Buddhist cultures, like any other cultures, are not always very Buddhist. And it's very helpful to make a distinction between what is Dhamma, right, what is the truth, the reality that the Buddha was teaching about, and what is Buddhism, so what's actually practiced in Buddhist cultures. And, you know, just as in a Christian culture there are many things going on which Jesus would probably be horrified at, the same way in Buddhist cultures there are many things happening which the Buddha was not teaching and which are quite contrary to the Buddha's teachings. So that's just humanity. People are like that. They're not perfect. And so when we're practicing Buddhism, it's important, absolutely crucial for us to keep our own sense of what is right and what is wrong. Okay? Don't give up what's right and what is wrong, and don't disparage those things that you've learnt and think that you have to sort of renounce all those things to become a Buddhist. This is not the case. Buddhism should be enhancing, if it's practiced properly, Buddhism should be enhancing and deepening your sense of what's right and what's wrong. And so when we're going to Buddhist countries, we distinguish between things which are Dhamma, which are really good and really worthwhile, and then things which are found in the culture and which are not necessarily part of really what Dhamma practice is about. The good news is that in Buddhism, even though it is very patriarchal in the sense of the structure of the monastic community, but at the same time, it's not so much a power-based patriarchy. There's still quite a lot of freedom for individuals to practice as they wish in different kinds of monasteries. And so even though, yes, we can talk on a structural level that there are these problems in the institutions, but it is still quite possible to find many places where you can practice happily and be respected and supported for your practice. Within the Buddhist community, there is a fine balance between the monastic community and the lay community. And even though the monastic community is providing spiritual leadership, and they seem to be the ones who say what's going on, the reality is that the lay people are the ones who feed them every day. And if the monks don't eat, right, they are going to find that their timeless traditions can be changed more quickly than they thought that was possible. Yeah? It's crucial, so important for women to support other women. This is the most single thing. Support the bhikkhunis, not just for women to support the bhikkhunis, everyone should, but especially for women. You need to support the bhikkhunis, you need to support women who are doing their spiritual practice, no matter where or in what capacity they're doing it. People in the Buddhist community need to know that it's okay. It's not the end of the world, right? Nothing bad is going to come from it. There are bhikkhunis in many, many Buddhist countries now, and nothing bad has happened, okay? All it means is that there are women's communities of people who are meditating and doing good things, helping the community and living a good life. That's all. So there's nothing to be afraid of. And so through the practice of generosity, of kindness, of giving and supporting, speaking out in favor of bhikkhunis and doing what you can to help, then these things are what's going to make it possible for the bhikkhunis communities to flourish in the future. The Buddhist monastic community was established by the Buddha in the Buddha's lifetime, and that includes bhikkhunis. And the bhikkhuni sangha is one of the world's oldest continuous spiritual traditions, and the Buddhist texts contain what's possibly the oldest book spoken in women's voices about their own spiritual experiences, right, dating from around 500 BC. So that was an intrinsic part of the early Buddhist community, so much so that the Buddha said that that was his mission. When he began to teach the Dhamma, he said, "I will not die until I have established the fourfold community." And that fourfold community is the monks and nuns and the lay people, lay men and lay women. So four aspects of the community that must be established before the Buddha's life's work is complete. Not only that, it's not only that there have to be those four communities, but that each of those four communities must be widespread and popular, and they must be well established, and they must have people in them who are learned and expert and capable of teaching the Dhamma. And so from the earliest times, it wasn't merely the fact that the bhikkhunis were present, but the fact that they were active in teaching and propagating the Dhamma, and that this was considered by the Buddha to be an essential part of establishing his dispensation. The stories that people bring up all the time in the context of bhikkhunis is the story of the ordination of the Buddha's auntie, Mahaprajapati, which is supposedly how the bhikkhuni order came to be. Now, in fact, as a historical and text critical scholar, I've done a lot of research into this story, as have many other scholars, and all of the scholars who've researched it have concluded that this story is not an authentic story. This is not what actually happened. And in fact, if you look at it closely, it's obvious that this is the case, okay? So, what did actually happen? Well, according to the story, given in the traditions. When the Buddha's auntie came to the Buddha and asked to ordain as a nun, the Buddha refused her three times and then laid down a list of rules called the 8 Garudhammas for her to keep as a condition of her ordination. And that's how the Bhikkhuni order came to be established. And in fact, in the passage, it gives a rather terrifying series of similes, like that ordination of women will be like a plague of that's going to destroy the crops, right? The disease of red rot that's going to destroy the sugar cane, or like a flood that's going to wipe out the cities. Okay, and these are very powerful images, very emotional images, right? And as a rule, the Buddha was not prone to saying this kind of thing, especially when there wasn't any reason to say it. So what actually happened? Well, that's very hard for us to say. It was 2,500 years ago. My own conclusions based on the research into that was that story is a sort of garbled memory of the ordination of the Buddha's auntie, who was like many members of the Buddha's family, okay, was a bit problematic because she was very proud of her son. Okay, so the Buddha's auntie or stepmother, she raised him as a child, she looked on him as her son. So she was very proud of him. The same thing is said of the Buddha's own son and of other members of the Buddha's family and so on. This is a normal feature of all of the stories about the Buddha's family, right? They caused problems in the Sangha because they're very proud of their relationship with the Buddha. So I suspect that what happened was that when she came to ordain, the Buddha was a bit cautious about her ordaining because of her very proud attitude and wanted to make sure that she would properly respect the Sangha when she ordained. I don't think she was the first bhikkhuni, and I don't think that the Buddha meant that those rules and so on should apply to all bhikkhunis. I think he meant them to apply specifically to his stepmother to show that she wasn't getting any special treatment or favoritism. I think the first bhikkhuni possibly was a woman called Bhanda Kundalakesa, who, when she came to ordain, the Buddha said, "Come, Bhanda," and gave her the full ordination straight away. And there are many indications in the texts that the Mahaprajapati was not, in fact, the first of the nuns. It's really important when presenting the narrative of the bhikkhunis not to focus too much on that story, because that's the story that the patriarchs will bring up again and again and again. Like, it's okay to address it, but it needs to be in a context. The thing that people forget is that the most important statement on bhikkhunis in the early text is the Terigata, which is the voices of the bhikkhunis themselves. So if we want to promote the bhikkhunis, then I'd be much happier talking about the Terigata, which is actually where you present the voices of the bhikkhunis and see what they have to say. And that gives a very strong and very positive and much more historically realistic position, rather than focusing too much on the Mahaprajapati story, which is, like I said, historically dubious. And notice that that's reactive, okay? So that's the critiques I have. So you're buying in to the patriarch's narrative by responding to that way, okay? Right? So we have to be conscious of that. And so this is why I said that it's okay to talk about it, but we should be careful to put the bhikkhuni's own voices foremost. So we don't engage in the patriarch's narrative, we create a new narrative, right? And put the voices of the women, you know, in the center place, which is where they really belong. Yeah. So there's a list of rules called the 8 Garudhammas, or the 8 rules of respect, which according to the Buddhist disciplinary texts is supposed to have been imposed on the bhikkhunis. These 8 Garudhammas are sexist, and they require that the nuns, you know, bow to all of the monks, and that they can't speak in front of the monks, and these kinds of things. This is just the ordinary standard ways that the patriarchy silences women and makes them inferior. It's important to notice, however, that the Garudhammas do not provide any power of command, nor does anywhere in the Vinaya provide a power of command or a duty of obedience on part of women. And this is an important revolution in the relationship between men and women, and one which is not noticed often enough. Okay, monks have no right to order a nun to do anything. Okay, none whatsoever. However, there is that relationship through kind of the deference and the silence as imposed by the Garudammas, which does diminish the role of nuns and within the community. And these Garudammas are not authentic, they're not a part of what the Buddha taught, and they were introduced into the Buddhist tradition perhaps 100 or 200 years after the Buddha died, during a time when those kinds of attitudes were becoming prominent in the Sangha, and the texts were rewritten to incorporate these kinds of ideas and attitudes. Okay, so yes, so this is a change, perhaps a revolution in the way that Buddhism is practiced in the Theravadan countries. The prominence and the changes in the role of women has been something which has been debated in the Theravadan countries for the period of what we call Buddhist modernism, at least the 19th century. For example, in the 1920s, late 1920s, early 1930s, there was an attempt in Thailand to revive the Bhikkhuni order. A manuscript from Burma from around the same time says that there was a lot of discussion among the monks about the question of Bhikkhuni ordination at that time. So it's been going on for a long while. But it wasn't until the 1990s that we had the first really successful series of Bhikkhuni ordinations, which provided the foundation for the re-establishment of the Bhikkhuni order in India, Sri Lanka and Thailand, which has subsequently spread to other countries. Why did it happen then? Well, I guess probably just we were ready for it. I guess there was a greater awareness of Buddhism internationally, more of a sort of a consciousness of who we were as a Buddhist community, not just like in each of our local spaces, more of an awareness of the connection between different traditions of Buddhism, which allowed the sort of cross-fertilization of ideas, and I guess also it probably depended on having the right people at the right time, you know, having the people who had the guts and the intelligence and the dedication to go through with it. Equality is one of the fundamental virtues of Buddhism. When we look at the basic statements of the Buddha on things like loving kindness, right? May all beings be happy. Right? It's not making a distinction. Right? There's no kind of favoritism. May my tribe be happy, or may people of my race or my skin color or whatever be happy, and not others. Right? This kind of thinking is completely foreign to the Buddha and to the way that he taught. And he made it so central in his teachings that he was teaching only in order to help people to remove their suffering. That's all. And so if we start imposing these kinds of distinctions and divisions and discriminations, we're no longer responding to the central message of Buddhism. We've lost the heart of the Dhamma. And it's no coincidence that in Sri Lanka, when they began the Bhikkhuni ordinations, the monk who was the most supportive of the Bhikkhuni ordinations was a monk who previously had done ordinations outside of the caste system. Okay, in Sri Lanka, most ordinations happen within a caste system, which is crazy from a Buddhist point of view. The Buddha was totally opposed to the caste system, and yet this is how the ordinations are done today. So this here was a monk who understood this and who defied his own tradition to do ordination in the way that the Buddha wanted without reference to caste. And that same monk then went on to support the Bhikkhuni ordination for the same reason. It's the same principles of equality and non-discrimination which lie at the heart of the Buddha's message. Well, I'd like to go to see in the bhikkhuni monasteries and see what they're actually doing, you know, and to sort of focus on the life of the nuns, how they live together, how they work together, you know, what their practice is and so on. It would also be interesting to see their first of all, in the sort of inner practice, like what they do individually, the meditation and study, but also their community, right, how they work with the community. But also in terms of their relationship with the wider community, like to see the nuns in the role of being teachers, performing like rituals and services for the lay community and so on. That would be something that's very interesting. Yeah, I'm not sure if I mentioned this to you, but some years ago, I asked a friend of mine in India, a Sri Lankan monk. I said, "How's Buddhism going in Sri Lanka?" Right. And he said, "Oh, pretty bad." He said, "All the monks are disrobing and stuff." He said, "But the bhikkhunis are going well." And I said, how does the community responding to the bhikkhuni order? And he said, "To be honest, a lot of the lay people now prefer to invite the bhikkhunis to come to their house to do offer dharma and do chanting and so on, because they can see that the bhikkhunis are practicing much better than the bhikkhus are." So that's a really interesting shift, right? And so that would be, you know, really nice to see actually how that's happening within the communities, like going to the houses. Because that's, again, that's something that people in some of that Poland don't really see, right? You don't see, you maybe have like an image of a Buddhist monk or nun on a hilltop meditating in the forest, right? And that's a true image. It happens and it's great, right? But it's also true that they're there in the villages. They're there when somebody loses their child, yeah, in childbirth or something like that. And they're there at the funeral of the grandmother of the family that they've lived next to for their whole life, you know? And they're there in all of these moments that really mean things in people's lives. So that would be a really nice thing to be, just to see. So one of the things which, when we talk about the patriarchy in Buddhism, it's easy to overlook the fact that the historical reality was that there was an energetic, vital, and thriving women spiritual community within all schools of Buddhism from the time of the founding of the Dhamma by the Buddha himself, and that women's community produced the Therigatha, which is possibly the oldest collection of women's spiritual teachings in existence, as well as a number of other interesting and important statements from the women themselves. And we know that in the history of Buddhism through India, that the bhikkhunis were very prominent. They are mentioned in inscriptions and dedications and in the archaeological remains about the same number of times as the monks are. And they're also mentioned in the same roles as the monks are, roles as teachers, as memorizers of the scriptures, as organizers of large groups of lay people with large followings, who were prominent in sponsoring, for example, the building of stupas and monuments and things like this. So they clearly played a vital and prominent role within Indian Buddhism for all of that time. And of course that continues to be the case in those Buddhist countries that do have bhikkhuni orders, that is in the East Asian countries of Taiwan, Korea, Vietnam, China, where the bhikkhunis are strong and are a great contribution to Buddhism in those countries. So it's unfortunate that that has not been the case in Theravada countries in the more recent centuries, and I think that it's one of the essential features of a new Buddhism, a more vital world Buddhism, if we're going to create such a thing, that we're able to recapture that energy and that vitality which women practitioners can bring to the Dhamma. Was the Buddha a feminist? Sure, why not? Yeah? I mean, the Buddha was somebody who tried to overcome suffering, and discrimination against women is something that causes suffering. You know? It's very simple. And so if you recognize, right, if you look at the Four Noble Truths, first of all is to recognize the suffering, right? So was the Buddha aware of the special kinds of suffering which women were likely to face? Yes? Yes, he was, yeah? And there are many passages in the early texts where the Buddha recognized that women are subject to special kinds of suffering, and he put into place rules or teachings that would express that and try to mitigate that. For example, he said that women, nuns, are much less well supported, much less likely to receive alms food than the monks were. And so for that reason that the nuns shouldn't feel obligated to give their food to the monks, and made a rule against that to make sure that the nuns had enough to eat. So he not only recognized the special suffering that the women faced, but also he thought that it was important to put into place social structures that would try to mitigate that would try to provide protection for women and try to stop them from being discriminated. And so to me this is the foundation, that's all that feminism is. It's a recognition that this suffering exists and that we have a duty to try to do something to overcome it. And so for that reason I have no hesitation in saying that the Buddha was a feminist. Am I a feminist? Yes, I'm very proud to call myself a feminist, yeah. Not sure if feminists are proud to have me, but whatever, that's their choice. But exactly for that same reason, you know. One thing I think it's important to recognize is that the opposite of feminism is not nothing, yeah. You know, the opposite, it's just as much effort to be sexist as it is to be feminist, right? And so feminism is just a way of looking at the world which recognizes those blanks and those distortions in our mind that come when we have been conditioned from these sexist points of view. So once we start to question that and to try to see, well, actually there is another way of looking, another way of seeing, then we realize that what we thought was just natural, right? We think it's just natural to see the world in this way, but in fact, it's a very carefully constructed sort of cultural situation which enables the patriarchy. I'll just give one example of that I noticed a little while ago. I was doing some research into Buddhist texts and whether I could translate in a non-gendered way. And of course in English you have a default masculine gender, and there are forms you can use in English which are ungendered, but they're kind of looked down on by the grammatical specialists. But the interesting thing was that historically that those gender-free forms were actually quite popular and are found in old forms of English and were disparaged by male grammarians and writers of dictionaries. The men were controlling the universities, they were controlling the journals, they were controlling what's right and what's wrong in language. So to use the masculine pronoun in English, it's not somehow natural or inevitable, it's a patriarchal construction. And so this is just one of the many instances of this happening. So for me, the feminism is not something which is really kind of optional. You know, I think it's crucial that we all be feminists and that we all recognize that a commitment to equality should be part of our spiritual practice.